Managing Violence Podcast, Season 6, Episode 10, Living in the Deep Brain with Rory Miller. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast, Season 6, Episode 10. That's right, the final episode of Season 6 is here with us, and it is the end of an era for the Managing Violence Podcast. For those that are not members of the Managing Violence tribe, you might be a little bit confused as to what I'm talking about. Never fear, we're not going anywhere. But what we are doing is changing our format a little bit. So as of the next episode, we are abandoning the seasonal format, which means that we'll just go to strictly numbered episodes. I believe the next one will be number 64, Managing Violence Podcast number 64, because that is how many episodes we have released over the past 2 years. So you'll notice that when the next episode drops, which will be in 2 weeks' time, taking 1 week break between this season and the start of, the numbered episodes. From the next episode onwards, it'll just be straight up Managing Violence Podcast, episode 64, and so on. So that is a very slight change. Probably doesn't really change much for you guys. For me, it just changes the way I organize the episodes and the seasons, making sure they're balanced and so on. Now, today I am joined, fittingly, for the end of an era with the very first quote-unquote big-name guest that graced the show back when I had no listeners, no followers, no subscribers, and really no idea if this would even work, or even what I was trying to make it happen. Rory Miller accepted the invitation to be on the show. And that, to me, was an incredible honor, because I'd been such a fan of Rory's work for so many years, and the idea that he would take time out of his schedule to talk to this random guy in Australia and share his knowledge and give up his day to talk to me. In fact, I think in that first episode, Rory even got in his car and drove somewhere to get better reception so that we could record a little bit more clearly. And Rory has since become a friend of mine and someone I'm very privileged to call a mentor and an advisor in many ways. And today we'll be discussing Rory's most recent book, Living in the Deep Brain, which is all about how to train your intuition. We talk about intuition a lot in the self-defense and violence management world, but very few of us actually know how to get better at it or how to tune it in or how to make it more receptive to the right things. And that's what Living in the Deep Brain is all about, and that's what we'll be discussing with Rory in this particular interview. But before we do that, I need to give a shout out to our latest tribal elder, Mr. Vaughan Jackson. Vaughan has been a long-time listener and has interacted with me quite a bit on social media, so I know a bit about Vaughan. Vaughan, thank you for your contribution. Glad to have you on board as a tribal elder. And also, of course, a shout out to our sponsors at Australian Warfighters Coffee, www.australianwarfighters.com, for the best coffee, and also to support some people that are really doing the right thing by veterans, by helping Aussie veterans get back into the workplace, either through employment or through training. They're great blokes and fantastic coffee as well. All right, that's it. That's all the news. Let's get into Rory Miller. Here we go, Living in the Deep Brain with Rory Miller.
I'm joined here by the one and only Rory Miller, a three-time guest, joining the elite club of two people that have been on the podcast three times. Rory was the first big name guest, if we want to refer to big names in the industry, that I had on back in episode 4, I think, when I didn't even have a listener base. Rory agreed to be on the show. For that, we are eternally grateful, because I think it was having Rory on the show that made other people want to be on the show. So you've been foundational to the podcast, my friend.
Okay, that is creepy.
Been some interesting developments since we last spoke. I mean, we've had everything happening in the US in your backyard at the moment with fires. Prior to that, or I guess ongoing, you've had protests and riots. A lot's been going on, man.
It has.
Actually, I wouldn't mind, we're already deviating from the topic that we said we're going to cover, but I know you went to check out, I guess get a first-hand view of some of the protest action and riot action. Do you want to talk through a little bit about that, about what led you to go in to have a look and what you observed?
If you want, the first time there was the CHAZ. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but a group of people took over a section of Seattle and declared it an autonomous zone, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, hence CHAZ, which is like the most preppy possible name for a anarchist movement. And there's a bunch of weird stuff in that, because what is clearly apparent that they weren't autonomous within a couple of hours, because you can't produce your own food, can't get rid of your own waste. They were still reliant on other people for every aspect of survival. And once they started getting some pushback on that media, and it wasn't the kind of aggressive pushback, it was the kind of you children are so silly, that they rebranded and changed the name. And that, if we're thinking about the tactics of it, that means that they actually had a fairly deep knowledge of advertising and branding. It's without that, you wouldn't have thought to change the name. You wouldn't have known what to do. Mm. So it's one of the very interesting things about this, a lot of these movements, is how consciously they're branded. Mm-hmm. If someone wants to say, I'm Antifa, I'm anti-fascist, no one's pro-fascist. So if you just go with the name and the branding, it's super hard to argue with them. If you look at what they're doing, and they're doing everything that Hitler's brown shirts did, I mean, write down the script. You can start to argue that. They'll go, but we're anti-fascist, so we obviously aren't doing anything bad. Yep. And they've got enough coverage from the media and politicians that that's allowed to stand. So that is the thing I think is, anyway, just looking at how branding and advertising is being used to push movements right now, when the movements are clearly not what they're calling themselves. Mm. So
very interesting.
So anyway, I had my friends on the left, American left, which is different than the rest of the world. My friends on the American left saying that, you know, it's basically just a summer fest. It's not a big deal. They're up there. I think the quote from the mayor was, they're eating Tim's chips and drinking Mountain Dew. Okay. And then I had my friends on the right saying they set up armed check posts. They're, you know, it's a hellhole. And so I just had to go up and see for myself. And so I spent a day, and up until about 11 o'clock at night up there. And it was, a lot of them were just super sincere. They were like the college sophomore that really, really believes this is really the right thing to do. This is cool. The things I saw that stick with me, and it goes into the sincerity of the movement. When I went out there first, you know, I wandered around, I saw some stuff. They had the tent city set up. They had their garden. I want to check out that, because my wife's really into gardening, and she wanted to critique them and see if they were doing it right, because, you know, God forbid you should not do plants correctly. And then went out to the field, and it's in a park with a big sports field. And there are a whole bunch of circles in the field, and the circles were critique groups. They were getting together. Anyone could talk about what they were going on, what they needed to do better, which is actually better than most organizations do for lessons learned. Mm. I happened to wander into the first one where they're talking about the security team. Okay. I hadn't had my radio turned on while I was driving out, so I didn't know that there'd been a shooting the night before. There'd been two people shot.
Right.
And so I'm seeing that this first one comes out. She's a woman. She's just frantic, almost incoherent. You know, what happened last night? Who did it? Why are we lying? And she just, and then someone else would get the microphone, the bullhorn. And it was, well, I don't want to say anything bad about substances, because you have a right to put anything in your body you want. But if you're on the security team, it's kind of important that you be sober enough to like walk when people call for help. I think that's very important. And then one guy stands up. There are a couple more in there, but one guy stands up. I remember, because he's like dressed all in black. He's got like blades dripping off of him, you know, way more blades than he has hands to use. He's one of the security team, and he opens with, "Hi, my name is Strider. And then he went into trying to explain that they're really doing the best they can with the security team, but it's really hard to vet people when no one's using their real name and you don't want to leave a paper trail.
And you also don't want to hurt anyone's feelings by saying you can't be in the security team.
Yeah. So that was interesting. And I wandered around a little bit more and got to see the Chad security do a use of force.
Oh.
So I'm wandering around. I hear someone, it sounds like they're doing an MMA play, but oh, look, he's got him a leg lock. Oh, he's out. And so I wander over and there's this guy and there's a whole bunch of context. If you don't know, you know, West Coast American cities, there was a guy who'd been wandering around there who was a street preacher. Mm-hmm. Okay, tall, skinny, I would say meth would be his thing. But I would bet, just from knowing the city that well, that his shtick during normal times, you know, not coronavirus times, or is to go into crowded places with affluent people, start screaming really loud about God and the end is near until someone gives him some money to go away. Mm-hmm. And he goes and does it again until he has enough to get either food or another hit of meth. So he is being evidently, because I didn't see the start of it, loud and disruptive. They didn't like what he had to say, so they decided to do something about it, they being Chaz security. And it was awful. It's, for one of their demands is that police not use pepper spray on them, but they sprayed the shit out of this guy. They hosed him down. And then they're trying to like get control of his arms. And at the end, they've got six on this guy, and they kind of like are trying to control him without really touching him because he's a little icky. And he's just at one point just sitting down, just rubbing his eyes, and then they feel like they have control. But that's when they realize they don't actually have a plan. They don't have any place to put anybody, and they can't throw people out because they're all about freedom. And so they're just kind of milling around trying to figure out what the next step is. So I found it interesting. Couple weeks later, Portland was getting really bad. I went down to Ground Zero in Portland and I hung out there all day, and it was, I don't like being around people a lot anyway. It's like one of my horrible places to imagine or to be is a concert, a rock concert. Tons of people, you don't know what's going on, super loud, your senses are overwhelmed. So this place was so crowded and packed, it was like being a rock concert without any good music. There'd occasionally be chants and shit, but the only redeeming thing about a concert had all the bad stuff, none of the good stuff. And I hung out there till about 11, and it's like, you know, nothing's going to kick off. And as I'm in the car walking, listening to the radio, it's kicking off. If I'd stayed another 10 minutes, I could have gotten the whole fireworks and Molotov cocktails and all the other shit they were doing. But I got bored and left early. So I missed that one.
So not quite the threat to national security that it might have been.
It's the threat to national, or the threat to any kind of security, is not in what they're doing. It's in the response. Because it's like they are going to escalate until they get reined in. And it's almost like, you have kids, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, when they're in there at testing phase?
Yep.
They're going to be bad until you tell them no. And they're going to escalate the bad until they're told no. So it's the threat is not in what they're doing. It's in the lack of response to it validates it.
It's very profound. I think, you know, from the outside looking in, there seems to be a lot of that going on at the moment, throughout, you know, various cities, a lot of tolerating behaviors that probably shouldn't be tolerated.
Unless you want to set the precedent, it's okay to try to, at one point, weld the door shut and then light the building on fire with people inside. Mm. That's not something that should ever be allowed, no matter who's doing it.
Yeah. Anyway, that's certainly a big topic, and we won't end up talking about your book. So let's shift gears to what we actually intended to talk about. You're kind enough to send a copy of your most recent book, Living in the Deep Brain, Connecting with Your Intuition. I think we briefly touched on it in a previous episode. I think maybe it was getting ready to be released, or maybe it had just been released the last time we spoke. But one of the things I find really interesting about the concept is that as a martial artist, as a self-defense instructor, certainly in the last 20 years, pretty much ever since Gift of Fear, people have talked about intuition like they know what it is. And before that, we kind of just accepted that we didn't know what it was, right? and then it's like, well, no, just use your intuition. You just need to listen to your intuition. You need to trust that feeling in your gut. And we started talking about things like your reticular activating system. And we started trying to apply some science behind it and saying, this is what it is. But no one's actually written anything about how do you train it? Like, how do you get better at intuition? It's kind of assumed that you have intuition and it's magic and therefore you need to listen to it. This is the first book that I can recall that really gave some actionable steps on how you get better at one, developing an intuition, and two, listening to it. So let's just start at the beginning. Like, where's the genesis of this idea? Where did it come from?
That was, did you ever read a Conflict Manager magazine when it was online, when it was out?
Yes, I've read a couple episodes, a couple of editions, rather.
Okay, because I was writing for that regularly, and I woke up one morning with this, ooh, maybe we should all write articles on what we do to hone our intuition. And has anyone written about that was the other question, because I couldn't think of anyone. And so I sat down to write an article, and I was going to invite other people, you know, write your version, and I kicked out 30 or 40,000 words in 10 days.
Wow.
It just, bleh. Cause it was deep in that. And it, again, like you say, people talk about it like they know what it is, and it's almost useless to do anything without definitions. So it's that knowledge bubbling up from deep down, or, you know, however we've done it, you know, you just get that feeling. That's not super useful. One of my friends says that one of his big transitions in shifting from someone who was learning to someone who was teaching, he was bouncing and he was very junior on the team. And one, the guy he was working with, the lead, goes, go stand over there because that's where the guy's going to run. And it happened just like he was predicted. And then Mark asked him, how did you know that? And he goes, I don't know, I just did. Years later, Mark tells a rookie exactly the same thing. We asked him, how you know that? He goes, I don't know, I just did. And they thought, I hated that answer when I got it. It's not acceptable for me to give it.
Yeah.
So within the intuition, it was one of those, you know, there was a need to try to, or at least in my thing, to try to explain what I'm talking about when I'm talking about intuition. And it's not the, for me, it's not the stuff bubbling up as much, because I think of it more in terms of action. It's the ability to act and react without processing it first, without taking the time to run through the list of shit in your head, to be as close to a pure animal as you can, which doesn't mean reject your training. It means trusting your training's internalized enough that it's just part of the decision process. And this ties into a whole bunch of research, you know, with fMRIs and stuff, that what's going on consciously in our brain has almost nothing to do with our decision-making process anyway. So spending time there is almost never useful. So yeah. That's the genesis.
Yeah. I find the whole subject really fascinating. There's a quote, and I need to find out who said it, because I keep using the quote and I don't know who to attribute it to anymore. But it said that human beings aren't rational creatures. They're rationalizing creatures. And, I really like that, because it explains so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's so much research and popular, fun to read research out there. I can't remember, it's like The Queen and the Messenger, but someone did the brain model as your deep brain is the ruler who actually makes all the decisions. Your conscious thought is occasionally they tell the stupid messenger to let people know what's going on. And so the stupid messenger is who we think of as ourselves, as us. And it just, and someone else said, and the thing is that the words in your head are not thought. They're the byproduct of thought.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting, because we only engage with the world through language and through labels and through symbols. And in the absence of having any understanding of language or symbols, how do we operate? But yet Yeah, children understand, like babies understand before they have language, before they have symbols. I mean, they're rapidly developing all of those things, but they still engage with the world. Animals still engage with the world without language. And and probably with a higher degree of efficiency than what we do, because they're not trying to justify what they're doing.
That's the big one, the higher degree of efficiency. And for fighters, I think that's, you know, I don't go fighting self-defense specifically, but for fighters, it's incredibly important. If you have to decide, figure out what he's doing and think about it and figure out what you should do in response, you're going to get your ass kicked so fast. And most martial arts schools I've been to have some, you know, they have this wisdom of the ancients, or like, you know, what the old guys say, which is if you think, you stink, or some version of that. It almost everyone who's shitty at sparring is shitty at it because they're overthinking it.
Yeah. Yeah. We sort of see that the classical white belt thing where you're not reading things as quickly, so therefore you're overthinking. How do I apply that technique that the sensei showed me earlier in the class or 3 weeks ago? Whereas when you're a black belt or you've been training for 3 or 4 years consistently, your body recognizes and just does stuff, and you don't really know why it just happened.
Well, and there's a curve to that, or at least in my experience, is like a lot of the. Everyone has a story about a brown belt or a black belt getting their ass kicked. But for every story about that, everyone also has a story about someone who only had one lesson who defended themselves successfully. And it's one of those, so in this curve thing, you've got this, I only know one thing to do, so I'm going to do it. And it never occurred to me to doubt the person that taught me doesn't know everything. So they pull off some shit and they always expect it. And then when they hear stories, oh my God, that worked. Yeah. And then you get up to the green belt, brown belts, where they're thinking too much, they know too much, but they haven't internalized any of it. Mm-hmm. And that's the conscious incompetence to conscious competence stage. Mm-hmm. And then when you get down to the unconscious competence, then you get back into just something you do and you don't think about it anymore. Yeah. And a lot of people don't get to that stage, too many.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting model you kind of articulate there, because you see a lot of people that give up on a skill because it gets mm-hmm. hard. And it's because they're in that middle phase where they have a lot of knowledge, but they don't know how to apply it, or they're overthinking it and they haven't internalized it yet. So therefore, they quit at that point because they feel like they've plateaued or they've reached the limit of their natural potential. But really, it's a growth phase that they need to persevere through.
My jiu-jitsu instructor, Dave, had a method for breaking plateaus, which was really effective. But when you felt that, or he noticed that you weren't improving, he would make you do nothing but the most uber basics. He would literally bore you off your plateau.
That's solid.
Yeah, it worked really good.
Yeah, actually, I know a boxing instructor that used to make people just spar with only jabs. And taking a competitive, high level amateur and just saying, you know what, you just get a jab for like 3 months, like you're doing nothing else. And if you have a good day, I might let you throw the odd cross, and that was it. Very very basic. So yeah, maybe similar concept. I think he was doing just to be an asshole, but you know. So there might be a method behind it.
A whole bunch of asshole things at work. It's yeah.
That's the quote of the episode. There's a whole bunch of asshole things at work. Rory, let's talk about training intuition. So one of the things I really liked about the book and about your approach to intuition is that oftentimes in this genre, when we're trying to build a skill set, it's like it's another course. It's more information. It's more it's more repetition. Whereas from what I kind of took out of your book, it's more about stripping away the unessentials. It's yes. about listening to what's already there. So you just want to talk about that process a little bit.
We can talk about it. And I'm not sure whether process is, we come through, and this is more in principles-based instruction, but most of what we learned about learning, we learned in school, right? Or in martial arts that are based on school learning. Kano is the one that really codified martial arts as martial arts, but he was an educator first. Okay, and yep. So we have this idea that we need lesson plans. We need to build up from this basic to this basic. We need to, the kids learn language and words and singing and arguing before they learn their ABCs. And I'll argue that we are all better at language than we are at anything that we train the way that we train martial arts. Okay. So it's when we codify it, we're actually engaging the part of our brain that sucks at just being. Where we're, if you want to turn off the part that overthinks things, you don't create a system where you have to overthink it in order to pass. So a lot of it is experiential. Beta tested a class. It just once the lockdown eased up, I finally got to do a live class, and we beta tested the awareness class. So I'm going to try to go off because there's stuff in the book, but this awareness is based on senses first. Okay, senses, and you don't interpret until much, much later. So it's senses, and then kind of knowledge and experience, and then interpretation. So there are exercises in the book, and these I think are super important on just being in your senses. So you just close your eyes and listen for five sounds. You come up with five sensations. Can you feel your hair? Can you feel the wind? Can you feel your butt in the chair? Can you feel the clothes on your shoulders? And you go with this, feel your pulse. And then the hardest is smells. But try to identify five different smells. And you won't have words for those. So you have to practice not using words to differentiate between the different smells. So this is senses. And then one of the second phases, I got to sail across the Atlantic late last year. So from South Africa to Florida.
I'm glad you mentioned this, because that was a section of the book that gave me so many questions.
Yeah, it was freaking awesome. But one of the first nights, so we're doing the first motor from St. Francis Bay up to Cape Town, taking it out of where the docks where they constructed the yacht to where we had to, the owners had to do all the paperwork. And I'm doing a night watch, and there are all these crazy sounds, all kinds of, and realizing every single one of those sounds, every sound everywhere means something. And so it's like opening the senses to actually hear the sounds, and then not trying to assign meaning to it, but try to figure it out, try to find it. So break it down, senses first, and then searching and educating yourself. And only after you do that can you interpret. And there were a couple of sounds I didn't figure out for, that was an 8-week trip, and like 7 weeks, there's something that happens to see that sounds like a cannon shot. there's something that sounds a lot like a pistol shot. And it turns out that there were blocks on the jib sail. Uh-huh. So when the wind shifted slightly, it could suddenly slam.
Yep.
And too hard plastic. But the one that sounded like a cannon was a catamaran. So sometimes it'd raise up and basically belly flop on the base of the bridge. Mm. But it took me 6 weeks to figure out what that sound was, because I was thinking, ghosts of pirates or some shit. So that senses, and then once you've had enough experience, then you can interpret the senses. But if your senses aren't clear, and if you haven't practiced being in them, there's a difference between smelling and smelling for something. Mm-hmm. And if you're going, there might be gas, like I'm going to smell for gas. You will imagine that you're smelling gas.
Yep.
Okay. So sense is clear. And then it's like, and this is a lifetime process of educating yourself on what things mean, what they look like. And this goes to everything from smells to reading facial expressions, to knowing in the place you're like, how does the air pressure change if someone opens the front door of your house when you're in your office? Mm. Okay, you know that. And then after that, you kind of consciously forget about it. So you aren't sitting there remembering that when the front door opens, then that curtain puffs. Mm-hmm. It goes curtain puffs, front door's open. And that, so don't know if I explained it really well, but that's the basis of the process. And then the other things are getting out of your comfort zone, the places where you know. It's one of the reasons why I like diving and snorkeling so much, is because gravity works differently. Gravity works backwards. I have to work to stay down, not to stay up. And so it cuts my ties to gravity, which is one of the things that is working on us all the time.
That's really interesting. There's a lot of sort of nuggets that I took out of what you just said, and I relate that to, for example, traveling, going overseas, being in a different culture, different smells, different sounds, and it can be really confronting for people. And I think this is why a lot of tourists end up just staying in the resort, because the resort is built to be familiar. You know, it's built to feel like home. Whereas they, even somewhere that's a tourist area, like I'm just going to use Patong in Thailand, for example, like you go out onto the main tourist areas and yeah, it's okay. But if you start going a little bit deeper, like things are different. It smells different. It feels different. The heat is different. The people are different. And if you're not actively looking for different, then it can be quite overwhelming, and people, you know, want to go back to their pina coladas in the resort pretty quickly. If you go with the attitude of I want to explore and I really want to push myself outside of my comfort zone, especially if you don't have command of the language, which is you lose that crux of language, huh?
Yeah, super fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does reveal how much we rely upon language. If you can't communicate and you don't know what the environment even means anymore, then that can be quite overwhelming for people that aren't looking for that experience.
Well, and I want to encourage everyone to start looking for those kinds of experiences, because that's where the growth is. I just want to say, because it's cool, and then just kind of like drop it there, because that cool is my universal word that means everything it needs to mean at the time. But we've made so many people so fearful that they think that they're outside their comfort zone, they're in danger. And we forget that that's where you did all your learning. That's where no one's ever fallen in love inside their comfort zone. No one who stays in their comfort zone has ever gotten good at anything. You know, we just have this long list. I mean, and I can argue that a martial arts exists to get people out of their comfort zone. And if you have confidence in what you've studied, then that should make you braver to take other chances in other places. Realizing that as a self-defense instructor, that I have to tell people that, of course, don't take chances, because you know that's where the self-defense thing comes in. But being safe is not always compatible with growing.
Yeah, we see that even within the very narrow confines of martial arts. You find someone who has developed a high level of proficiency in one particular style, and they won't deviate. They won't go outside and become a white belt in something else, because it damages their ego, the sense of hierarchy, the monkey brain emotions start flaring, because it messes with their identity.
Yeah, and white belt is where the fun stuff. Fun stuff happens at every stages, but when you study something new and you come in as a beginner, those first like 2 or 3 months, are where you get the big knowledge dumps. At some point, it turns into refining. But the entirely new concepts tend to be right there in the beginning. And it really opens your mind. And one other stupid exercise to encourage people: go to a library and go to a section of the library you've never been in before and pull out a random book and read it.
That's fun. Hey, when libraries reopen here, I might do that.
Yeah, that's how we ran into, I want to say, Anthony Bourdain, Kitchen Confidential. Decided to go to a section of the library I'd never been in. I don't read books about cooking. Not a thing. One of the funnest books I've read.
It's really interesting. You can't do that online, because all the algorithms are so well developed that you're going to end up with something that you liked anyway. So, yeah, it's really cool. I'd like to pull out something you mentioned in the book about children under the age of 8, you know, and 8 sort of an arbitrary number, but at what point we start second guessing our intuition and rather than just acting upon it. I just want to pull on that thread a little bit.
Okay, that was, this is almost directly from the book, because this is where I ran across it. One of my acquaintances a long time ago, and then that was right before we started the talk. We talked about how much I hate editing. Mm-hmm. So one of the things one of my acquaintances a long time ago had said that third grade teachers are almost third grade for us is 8 years old, are almost 100% accurate in predicting which of their students will grow up to be criminals. And it's like, I didn't know if it was true. It just kind of stayed in the back of my brain as a potential, you know, maybe true, maybe not, don't know. Mm-hmm. Then Malcolm Gladwell did his revisionist history podcast is really fun. He digs into some stuff, but there was, I think Carlos Can't Learn or Why Carlos Doesn't Read or something. And I don't remember the name of the organization now, but there are in the US scholarships to Ivy League colleges for kids from shitty backgrounds, for any inner city kids. And they go begging because no one applies for them. Mm. So they started doing the research. The reason no one applies for them is by the time they start thinking about college, all the kids that are smart enough and would do well have already funneled all their energy into learning how to survive in their environment. You know, whether that's running drugs or whatever. But this, according to Gladwell in that podcast, and then looking at the stuff later, is a little different. But their research showed that if you caught the kids at the age of 8 or before, then you could teach them college was a possibility. But if you caught them any later than that, they were too busy trying to survive where they were instead of thinking about where they could be.
Yeah.
And then the last one, Toby Cowan is Tread Lightly Survival. He's a former Royal Marine who likes being cold. I mean, he teaches survival class north of the Arctic Circle on purpose. he keeps trying to get me to go out there, and I have spent a night north of the Arctic Circle with him, but he keeps trying to get me to go out there on one of these courses. It's like, I could stay home and shove my shorts full of ice and get the same experience and stop when I want. So anyway, Toby's a little crazy, but we were out where he lives in Sweden doing some tracking, and he just brought up this, in a survival situation, kids below the age of 8 tend to survive. Mm. And rationale is for the, if you're thirsty, you drink something. If you're cold, you go, where's a warm place I can hold up? You know, younger kids pretend to be animals. And if I was a bunny, I would be in a burrow. So let me find a bunny burrow so they don't freeze to death. Mm-hmm. And then when I worked search and rescue, one of our things that used to fucking piss me off was you'd find someone who had a survival kit, but they didn't want to crack it open because that would be admitting they were in a survival situation.
Yeah. Wow.
Right. So that's a human worried about someone's going to, or an adult worried about someone's going to make fun of them, and a kid going, I'm hungry, I'm going to eat something. Oh, that tastes icky, I'm going to spit it out.
Yeah.
And it was just weird to me that age of 8 came up in 3 completely different contexts.
Mm.
So that chapter in the book is going over that, but it's like, you know, practice being 8 or younger, just play, let's pretend. And we haven't done this drill, but one of the drills in the drills book, The Plastic Mind, is basically applying let's pretend to your fighting ability. And if you pretend you're someone else, you move differently, and a lot of people fight better.
Yeah.
When you just by playing, and we say the words, you know, your mind is more important than your body. You know, it's really a mental game. We say all these words and then we don't practice it. Mm. When you practice it, it's really close to a superpower.
Actually, really interesting what you just said there about pretending to be someone else. I was working out with some MMA guys years ago, and you know, when you got a fighter preparing for a particular style, you have your training partners try to mimic their opponent, or at least mimic what you think he's going to do. And we actually had a guy who was basically plugged in just to be a sparring partner. He wasn't overly skilled. He just was the right size, and he was hey, go throw a lot of right hands, you know, and he actually found by mimicking this opponent that we were preparing to face that he actually developed his own style, because he realized, oh, I'm actually kind of good at this stuff. And it changed the way he fought just from the act of mimicking somebody else, which is really interesting.
And it's a little weird and creepy as an instructor when you watch someone, you give them just like a mental quit, like pretend to be someone else. Or one of the things we do is make up an animal style. And rationale behind that is how you organize the information in your head affects your efficiency in accessing it. So if you memorize 100 techniques, you're always going to be shitty because they don't have a thread that ties them together. Mm. If you can find whatever your style is, if you find the thread that ties it together, then it becomes one thing in your head. It becomes a gestalt. And so you can access it faster. And when you see someone in a 20 second instruction, you know, pretend to be this, and they improve more than they have in 3 years of active training, it's fucking disconcerting.
It's going to treat instructing as the quest to find that 20 seconds.
it's a surprise that the instructor quest is how fast can I get people good? Recognizing that good also includes adaptable and a bunch of other things. And we know that play works best for that. Getting into the child mind as much as possible, not making them overthink, not giving them information in a way that's made to overthink, not getting them more worried about you judging them than worried about whatever it is they're trying to do. We know all this stuff, but it's so outside of our paradigms for teaching. You know, again, going back to the teaching things in school, it's almost all closed systems where there is a right answer, where there's one right answer. You know, 3 + 4 = 7. There's nothing like that in a fight. There's nothing like that in self-defense. There are a whole bunch of ways to be wrong, but there are also a whole bunch of ways to be right. There's, if you aren't cheating, you aren't doing self-defense. You're fighting. there's just this long-ass list. Mm. And I think one of the biggest is because most schools are not really knocking people down, they're taking as their measurement of whether they're doing good what the instructor says. So they're infinitely more worried about being judged than about whether it works. Mm. That's crippling. If I'm worried about what an imaginary instructor is going to say about this when I need to knock someone down and get away, my head's in the wrong place.
Yeah, and I think we can see that in, you know, operational use of force training, whether it's security, law enforcement, whatever. If you're thinking about how the media is going to report this, how it's going to look on CCTV, how witnesses are going to report it, how am I going to document this? You know, like it cripples your response.
Yeah,
but it's a necessary evil, I guess. Unfortunately, like it has to be, or you need to adjust your training so that what you do is defensible. But it's hard.
It's not as hard as we think. So you know me, so you know I'm trying to put stuff into words. I'm trying to talk human. It's not
easy. It's easier with video, though. Yeah, cool. I can see the thinking happening.
Yeah. So it's if your internal ethics, if your morals, your ideas of right and wrong are actually internalized. Okay, if what you think is right and what you think is wrong are deeply held beliefs, not just words in that you spout, then if anything that comes up in training glitches, you'll recognize the glitch and you'll work it out. If nothing that comes up in training glitches, it's all okay with your ethics. So in that thing, I switch it. It's not your job to do the right thing in the moment. You will do the right thing in the moment. Trust yourself on that. It's your job to be able to explain afterwards why it was the right thing. And that's why we separate. And it's like, I don't even try to call it a law of self-defense course anymore. It's an articulation course. You're going to make this decision very quickly. You won't have all this information, but unless you're a pathological asshole, it will almost always be the right decision. But you need practice in explaining it.
And yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's something Mark McYoung talked about when I interviewed him as well. We were talking about the aftermath of violence, and the ability to explain what happened is such a missing skill set. It feels like the only way you get that is through getting it wrong so many times that you get smacked with a cane so many times you start to figure out what was the right thing to say. But and that's only because it's not taught. I mean, it's no one says, hey, when you did this, this is how you explain it. And if it's a high stress situation, your memory of the events will be distorted.
Absolutely distorted. Yeah. It comes to or says, but separating the explaining. And this is pushing the power down, which is one of the most important things you can do, whether it's a leader, as a teacher, is letting the students know you trust them. They will make the right decision. It's going to be this big fucking horrible blur. But that doesn't mean it's your, and this goes into the deep brain. Your deep brain is going to be taken over in the fight. It will. But if your ethics are just as much as part of your deep brain as your physical skills. Okay. It's, so trust that the answer will be right, but you need to explain the answer. This is like your math homework. Sometimes you know what the math is, you know what the answer is, but you have to show your work so that other people know you weren't. Okay. That said, one of the other things that goes into self-defense, when someone is honestly trying to kill you, it is damn near impossible to use too much force to do anything you're going to get in trouble for. If there's a 50 kilogram girl being attacked by two 240 pound guys with clubs, and she's got nothing else, and she grabs a butcher knife and stabs them both, no one's going to have any problem with that. The only thing that people really mess up in self-defense when we have this conversation at all is when they're worried that they're going to get into an ego fight that they want to call self-defense afterwards.
Yeah.
And if you take that off the table, it's really hard to make a bad decision. Mm. If someone is honest to God trying to hurt you or kill you, it's hard to make an excessive decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I guess the hardest one is when you see something that you know means X, but yeah, fast forwarding, you're thinking about the jury won't know that means X. Yeah, they'll just see that as something else. And I guess we see this a lot with law enforcement, where they're second guess for a shooting because they saw a movement that they know, but the way it's going to look on the media, the way it's going to look to the jury is different. And be able to articulate that, or having an expert witness who can verify what you thought. Yeah. And especially when you're talking about the consequence of this decision might be losing my job, going to jail, being killed in prison. I mean, they're pretty significant consequences to be thinking about in the moment.
And this is why you don't think about them in the moment.
Yeah.
And for that matter, I beat the shit out of a guy because he spun and stuck his hand under his shirt. And I wasn't going to see what he pulled out. I bounced his head off the wall, the table, and the floor. Mm.
I can't do it fast. Yeah. I had two incidents where someone reached behind them into their waistband, and both times I dropped the guy at his head. And neither time did the hand actually retract from the waistband. And both times there was a knife, but neither time did the knife get deployed, and someone asked me, well, you didn't even know he had a knife. I said, I don't care if he had an itchy ass crack. He's not going to do that while I'm talking to him. I'm not going to take the chance.
Yeah, if you want to see, you know, knife, gun, you know, you don't know. And if you take time to find out.
Well, yeah, that's a significantly different situation. I'd much rather get it while it's still inside his pants.
Yeah, and much easier to – and he shouldn't get the draw 1 sec. That's one of the things you should lock down. Mm. Is pin that hand exactly where it is.
Yep.
While you're bouncing his head off everything hard you can reach.
Yeah. Yeah. Coming back to some of the survival aspects, I really liked what you wrote as about going somewhere where there's no noise and there's no stimulus to be able to train your senses, or I guess to reawaken your senses. It's something I love camping. I know you're a big camper. But I'm guilty of when I go camping, like I take reading material, like I take something to occupy my brain, in between, you know, enjoying the nature and whatnot and trying to stop my children from dying. I take it as a time to sort of catch up on some reading and do some other bits and pieces as well. But I really like that idea of just going and separating yourself from anything that is really reflective of another human being or society. It is startling how uncomfortable complete silence is.
Yeah, and if you want to wean yourself away from the books, tracking actually takes to me, for me, a similar part of my brain. It's trying to read the ground.
Hmm. Interesting.
There's so much information there, and it's completely invisible. And then you learn to see it, and you have to stay in practice. I went through a phase, and it's fading, or it's faded really hard now. I can still pick it up after a while, but it's amazing.
I guess so, because it's almost like that narrative concept in your brain, like you're trying to piece together information into a cohesive sequence. It makes sense that it's similar to reading. What do you think the benefits are when it comes to training intuition, to be able to detach completely from all that external stimulus?
It's not all external stimulus, it's artificial external stimulus.
Yes. Yep.
So I have one of my friends, Bev Baker, that we argue about this, because she says she can do it in a city just as well as I can in nature. And I think she's right, in the sense that, again, in a city, every sound means something. Every smell means something. What I find is that most people, when there are people around, they're more worried about what those people are thinking than they are about what they're doing. And people are always the center of their own universes. And so when you're around people, you think everyone is paying attention to you. Everyone's trying to figure out what you're up to. Mm-hmm. And realistically, no one notices you. No one cares. First time, my first girlfriend in college kissed me in public, and I was so, but, and she's going, you know, everyone here is so worried about what other people are looking at them that I could do you right here and they wouldn't even notice. People are just incredibly self, and it was a huge epiphany for me. But I
hope you called a bluff.
What?
I
was too shy at that. I'd like to think that at this age I would, but you know. But that was the thing is again, it's an artificial worry, that artificial idea. So imaginary people start affecting your behavior, and that's the part that the getting to the silence is, shutting out the voices in your head. Because they aren't real voices anyway. So that's why I like it.
Yeah. It's interesting. You talk about people watching, and it's something I've recommended to students over the years. You just sit in a cafe and watch people and see what maps of meaning you can create around their behaviors, proxemics, all this sort of stuff. Just try and figure stuff out and just see what's normal, what's abnormal. See how someone's dressed and how you can predict their behavior based upon this. And I actually had a really interesting experience many years ago. I was working as an honest secondman doing a fire and evacuation training, which is not something I'm passionate about, but yeah, just ended up doing it. And I was delivering it at basically a meth clinic. Methadone clinic. But I was there really early. Like I was there 2 hours beforehand. It was early in the morning, like 7 o'clock in the morning. So the place wasn't even really open yet. And there was a cafe across the street. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to go get some breakfast and I'll sit there and I'll just people watch. And watching who came in and trying to read. I mean, it was an inner city location, corporate area. And just trying to pick based on how people were approaching the building, what they were wearing, how they were acting, who was going to go in and who was going to walk past. And that was really fascinating for me, because I got it wrong more often than I thought I would, as to who was going in to get their methadone. But what you say about people being the center of their own universe, the very first close personal protection course I ever did, we did an exercise on counter surveillance. And one of the drills that we had to do was basically, again, we're in a city location, was to just pick a random person and follow them for as long as we could until they made us. Mm-hmm. And that was confronting. It was terrifying. We thought, oh, yeah, we're going to get arrested. And it was amazing how long you could follow a regular human being around a city, and usually within a couple of arm's lengths, and they would have no idea, absolutely none.
It's one of the drills we do at Viaday sometimes, is stay within 5 feet, within a meter and a half of someone for 5 minutes without them, not necessarily without them knowing, without them triggering.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was like we had a couple of warning signs, like, okay, if they start crossing the street twice, you know, like if they start trying to take some sort of evasive maneuvers, then you're made, just leave it alone. But it was amazing how long we could stay in close proximity before anyone noticed.
Yeah, it's the one of the other fun things we do with the tracking is it's a pivot. So you get someone walking towards you, and as you cross, you do a quick U-turn, so you're in their blind spot right off their shoulder, but within a foot or 6 inches. So it looks like you're walking together and you're very close friends, and the other person doesn't even know you're there.
Mm.
it's crazy how fun it is. Stalking is in our genes. Hunting is something we evolved to do. And the only really fun things to hunt right now are people, especially if you live in a city. So occasionally dusting off those skills and honing them is, I think it's really good for us, for the intuition thing, because you also you listen to the voices in your head and how they're trying to, like you were saying, talk you out of this. You know, this is not right. They're going to know.
Yeah. And
it is, we've been so thoroughly domesticated. And that's something we kind of need to get over.
Yeah, it makes you realize how vulnerable most people are, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you feel like you're being so obvious about it, and they're completely oblivious. I worked a little bit as a private investigator as well, and just being able to do surveillance on someone and to literally tail their car or to follow them in public or to have camera gear on them and have zero trigger for them, even though in most cases they should have known they had something to hide because they were doing things that involved someone paying a private investigator to follow them. It was just crazy, mind blowing, and I guess that intuition was switched off. I mean, it was they were so distracted by their own life, they're completely unaware of the danger they're in.
That was another thing from the same thing. But as much as people forget that they're hunters, we were also hunted for a good piece of our evolution. I was talking to a captain of a different ship, and he'd done a really long solo crossing. He's like, "How do you sleep?" And he said he slept it, you know, 15 minutes to an hour at a time. And this is for weeks. And he goes, I think it was actually more natural because that's how we probably slept when we were being hunting all the time, when we were being hunted all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a really good perspective.
That is really interesting about natural sleep cycles and that, yeah, mm-hmm. that 20-minute window. Maybe there's an evolutionary reason for that. That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I never really considered that before.
Well, and Blaine, brains are one of the weird, we have a whole bunch of things. Sorry, I'm going to go off on a tangent. We have a whole bunch of things that we know and are true and scientifically proven that are also bullshit. And I think it's because they work at different layers and different times. So we've got this, you know, you need to be healthy 8 hours of sleep, blah, blah, blah. And then we have this guy who's sleeping for less than an hour at a time and doing it for weeks. And he's not only fine, he's more alert and more healthy. We know that you should work out your muscle groups in a phase with rest cycles. But have you ever gone heads up with a farm boy?
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing about a farm boy workout is you don't ever take a day off. You're milking the cows twice a day, two total muscle failure. And when you get the total muscle failure, you shake it out and you've got to keep going because otherwise the cow gets mastitis. And you're going to do it twice a day, every day, and there are no breaks, no days off. No days off from moving pipe or in season for bucking bales of hay. And that seems to produce a different type of strength than what we know scientifically about strength training.
Mm.
So I'm kind of endlessly fascinated by these things that we know, and then we have these known exceptions that we don't dig into enough.
Yeah, and you know what? I think sometimes the problem with science is that we often use science to verify what we already knew was true. Especially when it comes to human performance, you know, it's like, well, for example, like the studies on hypertrophy, like we're studying things that bodybuilders have been doing since the 50s to verify that they're true. So, well, we already knew they were true because we've seen the evidence of it over and over and over. We just haven't isolated it in a proper scientific context yet. And it's something I'm toying with at the moment on a study on verbal de-escalation skills. It's like, what do we actually use that works, and how do we isolate that in a scientific context to be able to provide some academic background on why it works?
So, my favorite disconnect. There is a book I'm trying to remember the title right now, but it's from the American War College, and it is supposed to be, and it's about 15 years old now, I want to say, but scientifically everything we know about interrogation.
Ah, okay, interesting.
And it's horrible. It's literally fucking horrible.
Oh.
it's all these academics, and so they do some things like they have shown scientifically that an experienced detective is no better at detecting deception than a college student. But they've set up the experiment so you come in, there are no consequences. You aren't going to go to prison if you get caught. You aren't going to get extradited to, you know, a black site somewhere if you get caught in a lie. And even if you do have a psychological issue with lying, you've been told this is for science. Yeah. So you're going to be asked four questions, lie on one of them. And so and there's no such thing as detecting untruth where you're detecting the stress over the untruth. And so they remove all the stress and say, see, there's no way to do it. Yeah. That was one of the studies. There was they had a thing in there called the Pareto curve, and I went and looked it up, and it's this huge mathematical thing with a whole bunch of shit. They were applying to one specific thing, which was in a negotiation. They had this curve, you know, this is, I get everything I want, this, you get everything I want, and somewhere on this curve is what we're going to get. Mm-hmm. And if you've read, I highly recommend it, but Never Split the Difference.
Yes. Yeah.
Great. Okay. In the real world, the only acceptable answer for a hostage negotiator is, I get everything I want, you get nothing you want. Mm-hmm. The only acceptable answer in real life was, according to academics, impossible. Mm. And so that was another disconnect. It was one of those, the theoretical possibility is somewhere on this curve. And it's like, no, absolutely nothing on that curve is acceptable. It's got to be here.
Yeah.
And we run into this a lot, largely because most of the stuff that happens in academia is an artificial situation. It's an experiment that's been set up. It's
a simulation within very controlled parameters, and it's very hard to replicate reality in that context.
Yeah. Have you heard about the theoretical physicist trying to explain herding sheep?
No, I haven't.
Okay. You just have to assume the sheep are spherical and they're on a frictionless surface.
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. All right, man. Let's bring the main interview to a close. We can talk all day, but we need to leave room for a part four at some point. Rory, I know you've got a bunch of books coming up. You've got things you're working on. Is there anything you want to plug before we close?
Oh, let's see, plugging. I do have a Patreon. I don't know if you ever followed the old blog.
Yes.
But I was getting questions I found aggravatingly stupid enough, I decided to put it behind a paywall. So if I do get some aggravating questions, at least they're paying me.
You have stupid questions for Rory, go to his Patreon.
Yeah. You got to pay me now to do that. So I do have a Patreon. The book I'm working on now, the one I'm in the editing process, I hate, is Glossary. That's the working title, just a list of words and concepts that really made life easier for me. Mm-hmm. And then the one after that, the one we talked about before, is I want to get onto that strategy primer.
Yeah. Excellent.
That one.
All right. Yeah. I'll put the links to your Patreon in the show notes for anyone that wants to support you. I highly encourage you to do that. Rory's probably, you know what? I don't think it's a stretch to say that Rory's work has been one of the most influential pieces in the last 20 years in self-defense literature, because He's got a way of articulating concepts that those of us in the field know are true, but haven't been able to explain before. And that's Rory's gift, is be able to explain things in a way that you go, huh, I already knew that, but it feels new. So thank you for that work. And the number of guests that we've had that have referenced your work and have recommended your work is a sign of how valued your contributions are.
Yay.
You're not good at accepting compliments, my friend. All right, Rory, thanks very much for your time on the main interview. You're going to do the bonus round in just a second, but for those leaving us here, thank you, Rory Miller. It is always so much fun talking to my old friend, Mr. Rory Miller, and some fantastic insights there, I'm sure you'll agree. If you'd like to hear 18 minutes of more content from Rory Miller, beyond what we've already done in the previous two episodes with Rory, but an additional 18 minutes, head on over to patreon.com/managingviolence, sign up to be part of the Tribal Council or the Tribal Elders, and you will get bonus content from Rory and every other guest from Season 4 onwards. Well worth the investment, if you ask me. All right, that's it, guys. I'm going to be taking a week off to relax. Who am I kidding? I'm probably going to batch record a bunch of episodes. But hey, I'm going to take a week off from dropping episodes. We will be back in 2 weeks' time for the numbered episode season. Not really a season. We're going to be back in 2 weeks. Until then, please join in and follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube. Go subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you haven't already subscribed to the YouTube channel, please do that. I'm hoping to get 1,000 subscribers before our second birthday, which is on the 19th of November. So we're only about 130 away as of time of recording. So go do that. Also, don't forget our website, www.violencepod.com. It has articles. It has reading list. That's right, I've published a reading list. Every book that I recommend you read on violence is available with purchase links on violencepod.com. All right, that's it for me for the next 2 weeks. Be good to each other, and I'll talk to you next time.